Next up on This Week in Law, we're joined by Andrew Arruda of Ross Intelligence and Joshua Browder of Do Not Pay. We're going to talk about Centaur lawyers piloting legal AI and getting out of parking tickets effectively 60% of the time via a chatbot. All next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twill. This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Emery Roan, and Mike Keyes. Episode 352, recorded July 15th, 2016. AI, oh my. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Braintree. Looking to set up payments for your business? Braintree gives your app or website a payment solution that accepts just about every payment method with one simple integration. Plus, Braintree will give you the first $50,000 in transactions fee-free. To learn more, visit BraintreePayments.com/twill. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and we're so thrilled that you've been able to join us this week for our wonderful legal AI episode of This Week in Law. We have two incredibly fascinating guests joining us this week, along with my co-host, Emery Roan. Hi, Emery. Good to see you.
Hey, Denise. How are you doing today? I am super excited to be here today. I think we've got, honestly, a really great show.
I do, too. And kudos to you for putting these two together in such a fine pairing to talk about legal AI. We'll introduce our really amazing guests here in just a moment, but I want to remind you, in case you're just for the first time tuning into the show, Emery attends California Western School of Law in San Diego, where he is not walking off any cliffs in search of Pokemon. He has worked, is working with, or is about to work with New Media Rights, the Privacy Rights Clearinghouse, EFF, and of course, us right here at This Week in Law. So I'm great to have you back this week, Emery.
Thanks for having me, as always.
All right. Now, we have two wonderful, fascinating, can't wait to pick their brains guests, both working at the forefront of AI when it comes to the law. Andrew Arruda is the co-founder, CEO, and part of the original development team at Ross Intelligence. Ross is a legal AI conceived during a 2014 university competition sponsored by IBM to find innovative ways to use Watson. Andrew, so good to have you on the show.
Happy to be here.
And also joining us is Andrew's good friend and sort of co-worker in the same field, Joshua Browder. Joshua, I just have to call a wunderkind. I get to use that phrase too infrequently on the show, but it applies squarely to Joshua. He created Do Not Pay, a parking ticket appeals chatbot that has had an incredible success rate. As of April, Joshua, I think your stats were a 64% success rate of appealing the parking tickets that it was turned loose on. Joshua also contributes to The Hill, and he wants to put AI to work in the service of human rights. So it's just wonderful to have you on the show, Joshua.
Thank you for having me.
Let's get right into it and talk about how robots are going to change the way law is practiced, the way you interact with the law, and possibly areas beyond the law. So I don't know. I guess I should start by asking you guys how you like your products being compared to robots. Do you sort of embrace that characterization or is it inaccurate? Let's start with Andrew.
Well, for us, I think it's always fun. I think robots, most of the time, they look adorable as well. So I kind of have a soft spot for them. But we really don't classify Ross as a robot lawyer. Really what Ross is, you know, AI that has a human at its core. So a lot of the time when you think of it as a robot, anything, you forget about the human element, and everything we build is built for lawyers to help help them scale their ability. So, you know, that's one thing that those robot comparisons usually fall short on.
Hmm. Right. And how do you feel about the robot analogy, Joshua?
Well, I think it's really good to kind of a robot like replaces people, and I like to replace parking lawyers. But I agree with Andrew, you know, neither of our robots have arms and legs. So calling them a robot perhaps is the wrong term, but it's the right term in the sense that you can kind of replace low level legal work and make things for free.
Well, I think that's sort of an interesting point here right off the bat. I know that, Andrew, you I don't know if shy away from the term is correct, but you definitely sort of cast this as, you know, a hybrid between AI and lawyers. But Joshua, I think that you are sort of unabashed about the idea that this is certainly going to be replacing some lawyers. I guess to continue on that question, how do you guys feel about that?
Let's back it up. I think that part of the answer to that question has to do with the difference between your two products/services. Ross mm-hmm. Intelligence does one thing and Do Not Pay does another. So why don't you start by telling us in your own words as founders and developers what each of them do? Tell us about Ross, Andrew.
Yeah, so what Ross does is really what we're trying to ensure is that lawyers can get from question to answer in terms of their legal research efficiently. So we've built a system. It's an AI assistant for human lawyers. They essentially kind of have a conversation with the law. So they don't keyword search, Boolean search is gone. They ask their questions like they would a human colleague. And what Ross does is it surfaces the direct passages of law that best answers their question. And so that's one part of what we do. The second part of what we do is the machine learning aspect, where the lawyers who use Ross actually upvote and downvote Ross's passages accordingly. And so the amazing thing about Ross is that it's always getting smarter. So every day that a lawyer logs in, it's smarter than the day it was before.
Hmm. Okay. And tell us about Do Not Pay, Joshua.
Do Not Pay is a chatbot to help people with their low-level legal problems, for example, parking tickets or delayed flights. And the way it works is it asks a few questions and users can answer in their own words. For example, it will ask, what was wrong with your parking ticket? Once it knows the issue with things like parking tickets, it will take down a few details, such as the road name where you got the ticket, and then place these details into a generic challenge letter, which you can send to the local authorities.
Right. So right off the bat, we've got a couple of similar kinds of services, but tackling very different parts of the legal process. Do Not Pay seems like a very limited, targeted kind of product service. It's only going to do one thing. It's going to do it really well because it does that one thing and continues learning. And Ross casts a far wider net and would look down its virtual nose, I think, at appealing parking tickets. Does that sound accurate, Andrew?
I don't know about that, but the last part. But I do think they're kind of different services for sure. And what I really like about what Do Not Pay is doing is, you know, a lot of the time, folks, when you get a parking ticket, it's not an incredibly large amount, but it's enough that means, you know, dinner, or, you know, that means a whole bunch of things. And so to go and get a lawyer to appeal that, sometimes it might cost more than the ticket itself. And so, you know, I really like that we're immediately seeing AI come in and helping folks there. And then what we're doing with AI is allowing lawyers to be able to cut down on a lot of that inefficient upfront grunt work that they have to do, which allows them to actually help clients quicker and actually more efficiently. So in both cases, what you're seeing is that AI isn't really taking away, but really enabling access to justice. And so sometimes when you get the robot analysis, or you get like folks thinking about some sort of an AI Armageddon, it's kind of a lot of that stuff comes from sci-fi. And really what AI is doing is helping a lot of folks.
So I think we've got from those descriptions and comments a partial answer to Emery's question. And Joshua, tell me if you think I'm right, that the reason you're able to disintermediate parking ticket lawyers is because they're not that necessary to the process to begin with. There's not that much that is complex about what they're doing. They knew a few rules and if-then scenarios that could be amply handled by an AI. But other than that, there's not a lot of value add that they're bringing to the process. Am I capturing that?
Absolutely. I mean, from my experience, you have these guys copying and pasting templates into Microsoft Word and then charging $100 to do so. And I think that's just the perfect thing to be kind of disrupted by technology. And I'm actually quite surprised someone hasn't already done it.
Mm-hmm. So tell us more about Do Not Pay. Let's delve a little deeper here into the reason that you decided that this was a necessary thing. You began to answer that a minute ago, that this was the kind of area where lawyers aren't really necessary to help people carry out their legal rights, correct?
Yes, and I got this idea from personal experience. When I turned 18, the driving age in the UK, I got a large number of parking tickets myself. And out of necessity, I had to figure out how to fight these tickets because I didn't have the money to pay. And one route was through these lawyers, who obviously I couldn't afford either. And I looked at the work that they were doing, and it seemed, as you said, just to be very formulaic. And I thought it would be such a great idea to create a bot that could replace them for free.
Hmm. So that brings up my question. I mean, on the spectrum of artificial intelligences, I know that obviously Ross is using IBM's Watson that is, you know, made national news for beating Jeopardy. It's very complex natural language process. Black box magic going on there. But in the other side, we have, you know, old school chatbots like Eliza and Cleverbot. Where on that spectrum does chatbot reside? And my question, my follow-up then is, if it's really close to the Cleverbot side of the spectrum, does that mean that this sort of model can be expanded to other areas of the law outside of parking tickets and flight delays?
Yes. So it's definitely on the Cleverbot side. And basically, it's quite simple AI, and I think it's quite powerful almost how simple what one can do with such simple AI. The challenge for me was understanding what a user has said. For example, there are a million ways to say, I got a parking ticket, or the parking bay was too small. And through this kind of Cleverbot AI, I figured out how to translate that into a defense that the bot can take and generate.
So is this, does the chatbot have, or the Do Not Pay bot rather, does that rely on some kind of like government API to interface with the law? Or, I mean, is this literally just you're taking documents and interpreting what the users are saying in the chat and then just putting it in the old documents and submitting it by email?
It depends on the jurisdiction. The chatbot currently works in the entirety of the UK and New York City. In some UK areas, it will actually send the appeal automatically, not through a government API because they don't exist, but kind of through brute force from one website to another. However, I haven't managed to accomplish that in New York City, and there are all sorts of legal issues with doing that because it could be considered hacking. I'm very kind of thoughtful about doing that, but... Yes,
could you go into some of those other legal difficulties that you've run into?
Yes. So another legal difficulty is obviously, if this is a lawyer, it doesn't have to be licensed by the Bar Association. However, because parking tickets are a consumer issue, I've been advised that that's not actually a problem. However, I really love reading these kind of interpretations of why Do Not Pay should not exist for regulatory reasons. But I've had no problems from the regulators themselves. But other lawyers love commenting how it's breaking all the regulations. But I love to see regulators actually approach me because they haven't.
Sure, there's a good analogy there between taxi drivers and Uber. There's a bit of encroaching on somebody's turf that probably flew at them out of left field. You bring up a really interesting point, and I'm glad that you are, that is front and center in your mind, that people developing tools like this, particularly yours, Joshua, have to have the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act front and center when they're thinking about how they're going to interface with government systems and get data out. What sort of precautions are you taking to make sure that you're not crossing that line into hacking?
Well, since the kind of popularity of the site, I've had lots of lawyers reach out to me and offer pro bono advice. So basically, before I do anything, I consult with my lawyers. I just ensure that, because the last thing I want is for this to be shut down. It's been helping so many people. So I'm just making sure, basically just consulting with lawyers to ensure that what I'm doing is not illegal. But at the moment, I'm confident that I've stayed above water.
Good.
Can I follow that over to Ross then, to Andrew, sorry. The issue that Joshua brought up about does an AI have to be licensed? I mean, I think that once we start getting to the more dense legal weeds issues that I think that Ross is designed to answer, somewhere along the way, you do have the questions of, is this AI licensed? How have you guys approached that? And I'm sure that you're seeing pushback from that as well. You want to discuss that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're actually not getting much pushback on that at all. And the reason why that is because the people who are asking Ross questions are lawyers themselves. The responses go to the lawyer who asked the question. They then use that to then form their opinion. So it's the human lawyer is never taken out of the process, just enhanced. And therefore, we haven't had any questions about that, just because all the folks who use Ross are lawyers themselves. Hmm.
Yeah, I'm old enough to remember, and I don't think any of you are, when Lexis and Westlaw were in their infancy and were not ubiquitous in the legal field. And I'm old enough to remember how they were adopted, as slowly adopted, and then became, you know, a thing where if you didn't have it, you were borderline committing malpractice, maybe beyond borderline. Yeah. That, you know, that and electronic calendaring systems, electronic case management, tracking, all that kind of stuff. There are now things that routinely law firm administrators tick off on a box when they're signing up to renew their insurance. And if you have them, you are rated one way. And if you don't have them, you are rated another. And I very much see this as a similar scenario where Ross or something like it to assemble information for attorneys to analyze will become a standard of practice kind of consideration. So good for you, Andrew, for getting in on this at this time and pushing it forward. One question I've had as I look at this and ponder how it might work is what sort of sources you are drawing from. I don't know if that's proprietary and you can't tell us, but you know, I mentioned Lexis and Westlaw, which are sort of the juggernauts of legal research, online electronic legal research. Does Ross draw on those and others? And is it an extension of the tools that a law firm is already using, I guess is my question.
Yeah, so I'll answer the second part of that first and then answer about source of information. So in terms of what your question about, is it an extension? Absolutely. Here's the thing, you know, legal research itself, really we're limited by two main sources. So we could use Westlaw or Lexis. And the thing about that is the way that they surface their information, you know, if you have an alternative, which is Ross, which is built in an entirely different way, which allows you to see other perspectives and be able to do research a lot more efficiently, the question becomes, are you doing your client a disservice for not using a service that offers what we do? And so I think that there's definitely going to be a bit of that. And I don't think just about Ross. I think when it comes to legal technology generally, there's a lot of moves in, and you see some bar associations already passing kind of ethical obligations for their lawyers to stay up to date with the latest offerings in technology in order to do and provide their clients with the best service. As for what we've done, we built Ross initially using publicly available data. But, you know, as we progressed, we saw that to be able to clean that and kind of continue to gather that was kind of a bit of a mess. And so what we did is we actually have since formed a partnership with a legal publisher. We haven't announced which, but that's how right now we are getting our data from a publisher.
I have a question, actually. This brings up the logistics of what using ROS is like. When I saw criticisms, first off, that I've heard criticisms from some lawyers that swear by Westlaw and Lexis that natural language searching simply isn't the best way of finding data or finding the right research for legal issues, that, you know, these people swear by complex Boolean searches with Westlaw. And my follow-up question then was, when a lawyer is asking Ross a question, are they doing legal research or are they avoiding it? Is Ross giving them an answer when, like, simply how is it presented to them? Do they ask a question and it says, ding, this is the answer? Or what does that look like?
Yeah, so on the first part of that, in terms of folks swearing by Boolean, I think that's just force of habit. Also, those, you know, those other services have attempted, and they do offer some natural language search. But as someone who did legal research myself for 6 or 7 years and who tried to use that natural language, it just didn't work. But here's the thing. I mean, your issues are presented to you as a lawyer in natural language. We communicate the issues of our cases at both as a lawyer and a client in natural language. So it only makes sense to interact with the system you're researching with in natural language. And as to the second part, what happens is you just ask your question to Ross. And, you know, in law, there's a lot of shades of gray. So it's very, very hard to really find a question that has a set answer. And actually, that's really why machine learning excels, because what machine learning enables you to do is actually see all the different shades of gray. And so we present a bunch of passages. We present our users groups of 10 passages at a time, and they can always go through and look for more. And then we allow them to interact with those passages, and we provide them to them ranked in terms of how confident Ross is that those answer their question.
And I guess that brings up a question as far as the logistics of licensing Ross. Is this are firms going to have to buy a HAL 9000 Ross for their corner office, or is this a web service that anyone can log into? And if it is a web service, how does that scale?
Yeah, so it's a subscription-based web service. And how it scales is very simply, we started in bankruptcy law. We're going to be going into a couple other areas. And what's great is, you know, we formed great partnerships and commercial partnerships with various law firms. And so as we continue to release Ross on different areas of law, you know, we have avenues and folks who are waiting for Ross in different areas. So we're really looking forward to not only spreading across the practice areas here in the United States, but all common law jurisdictions and then eventually civil as well, so that every lawyer in the world has access to Ross on their team.
So I know that, Joshua, your goal is to basically have every person have access to the law, or at least have the ability to work with it. I've heard, actually, Ross or Andrew, you've said that a lot or one of the driving forces behind the reason why you made Ross is also the sort of lack of the disparity between how many people have access to the law and how many don't. So is there a plan? Obviously, Joshua, your plan on the future is for everyone to have this. Is that on the roadmap as well for Ross? Should we be, you know, 10 years down the line, be able to pull out our phone when we get into a car accident and ask Ross how to best handle this?
Certainly not what we're thinking about. Really, what we're focused on is equipping lawyers with tools so that what you would be able to do is actually call a lawyer in that situation who is affordable and who can efficiently give you an answer right on the spot using ROS. And so, you know, the law is complicated, and especially when it gets into some of the more nuanced areas where there's various answers and various approaches, the human ability to compare, contrast, analyze, and empathize are something that I think you're probably going to want in that scenario, especially in a car accident. And so we focus on building out our tools to enable lawyers to do more. And to talk about what we're seeing, I mean, 80% of Americans who need a lawyer can't afford it, but then we're graduating record numbers of legal grads who are in records amounts of debt and who can't find work. And so, you know, we think here at Ross Intelligence that, you know, equipping them with Ross and a variety of other tools, they could end up doing a lot. I mean, what's to stop a lawyer from using Do Not Pay as well and to be able to help their clients for free and refer them to that? So it's all about forming a toolkit using technology, including AI technology, to do more.
Joshua, thoughts?
And just to kind of add to what Andrew has said, I've actually had lawyers email me, and I don't know why they tell me this, but actually some lawyers are actually using it to generate their own letters and then charging for those letters. And so I think, and I think that's really terrible. But
is that a violation of your EULA? I would imagine your terms could forbid that.
Yes, it I think it probably is a violation of my terms, but I'm not in the business of suing people.
I think it's a violation of their ethical responsibilities as lawyers.
Yeah.
Sounds like it could well be.
These parking laws, I think, have a low bar anyway of ethics.
That's fascinating that is happening. I wanted to sort of take us into the weeds and time travel back to 2004, which many of you on the show with me here today probably don't remember in an adult kind of way. But Cory Doctorow wrote this great book back then called Eastern Standard Tribe, and I remember reading it at the time and thinking that this was the first time I'd ever seen something like an artificially intelligent lawyer, or at least an automated lawyering kind of system. It was something called Auto Counsel that he conceived of, and it did apply to a fender bender kind of scenario where somebody wanted to quickly accomplish a settlement when they had a fender bender, and they jumped into IRC where they were directed to something called Auto Counsel. And Auto Counsel put them together with the right lawyer. The lawyer transferred their credentials via the chat, and also a smart contract that, you know, in 2004, we weren't talking about smart contracts, but this just tells you that Cory Doctorow, you know, is always thinking about these things. They finalized their agreement and were on their way. So Auto Counsel, it was more of a connective tissue between the lawyer and the client in this case. But it was funny because it happened quickly and by chat, and I think sort of was the precursor to Do Not Pay. Had you seen this before, Joshua?
I'd heard of this vaguely, but I thought Do Not Pay was kind of the first legal chatbot, but it's quite surprising to see this actually. I think the difference between this and Auto Counsel is that there's a human element with the lawyer on the other end.
Right. It was more sort of a let's sign you up as a client kind of tool, and then I'll take it from there. And I'm sure, you know, I mean, the implication was that things were just a good deal more automated in the world of the book. And I'm sure it would have proceeded apace from that point. That was all we got about Auto Counsel in the book, but it always struck me as fascinating. And 12 years ago, we're now seeing it play out in real life. It's really cool. On the theme of the most people having the most access and bringing costs down. If I understood you correctly, Andrew, right now the sources that Ross is drawing from are Westlaw and Lexis, correct?
No. We haven't announced the publisher we're working with.
Oh, okay. Got it. So it is an unannounced publisher. I was just wondering, I saw and congratulations that you were on the list of the Fast Case 50 this year. Always a great list of people innovating in the legal field. And Fast Case is a competitor kind of upstart to Lexis and Westlaw. So was just wondering, you know, depending on the law firm or the lawyer, I am now a sole practitioner, so I, you know, would not have access to the huge kinds of scaled tools that big law firms have. Mm-hmm. Or I might choose not to have that access because they're very pricey and I might not find it necessary for my practice. So I'm wondering if down the road, Ross will be the kind of tool that makes tons of sense. It seems to me like it would make tons of sense for small firms and solo practitioners, but if that's going to be a good fit or not, what do you think?
Yeah, so I got my start working at a very small law firm, actually, about four lawyers. And I worked there for, well, I worked there to pay for my way through college and law school. And eventually after my call to the bar there up in Ontario, I ended up getting involved in founding Ross. So didn't get to practice for more than a few days. But why I bring that up is during the time that we were developing Ross, we all very much thought that it was going to be something that solo and small law firms really love. And the reason for that is it, you know, when I was involved on a matter and I saw a very large law firm, you know, listed as opposing counsel, I knew that they had a ton of resources and I knew that they had, you know, 10, 15 associates in that particular practice area who could spend those hours opening up all 1,000 links in Lexis or Westlaw, reading through those cases and trying to find the passages that best help their client. And so what Ross does is really actually automate that process and really even the playing field. But what we quickly saw as we continued to move forward with Ross is that large law firms really loved it because right now clients have been really pushing back on costs coming out of 2008. And one of the areas they push back on most strongly is actually legal research. And so Ross allows you to still deliver the same great quality, but a lot without spending a lot of that time on a task that actually law firms are really having a hard time billing for. So why I brought that all up is because Ross really is a tool that can help a solo practitioner, a medium-sized law firm, a large international law firm, but the value they get from it may be different, but they all find a lot of value from Ross. Even in-house counsel, for example, you know, every time they farm out their matter, that costs them. And so if they can ask Ross a few questions before and get a grounding in that issue, when they do call up their outside counsel, it's a different conversation. It's further down and they've saved, you know, X amount of money. And if you do that consistently, you're talking about large amounts of savings.
Is it a little bit like when you go to the doctor having done research on your own on the internet about whatever medical condition might be wrong with you, though? I mean, is it a little dangerous to try and make decisions without the judgment to go along with it and the training and the education?
Well, I think the difference there is, and who hasn't done that? And usually you end up getting very scared, like, you know, but the difference here is I don't have a medical degree when I do that. And so the folks who are using Ross do have legal degrees, they're lawyers. And so they definitely know what questions they're asking and they definitely understand how to interpret the law. And so I think that's the difference there. It would be the equivalent of a lawyer, of a doctor using WebMD. I think they probably have a different experience.
Got it.
So when we're talking about, I know that Chatbot has been making waves for its 60% success number. I'm thinking, that's the line of thoughts that I'm thinking. But first off, I was thinking, well, does Ross have any competitors? Are there any other people that are trying to make AIs that also do legal research? And presumably, if there was, they would come up with different results necessarily from Ross. And so at that point, you have two different AIs. It's just not quite the same paradigm as when we're doing research as lawyers, looking through Westlaw, looking through Lexis, versus when we have artificial intelligences sort of helping us along the way, because legal research is part of our responsibility as lawyers. Mm-hmm. So I'm not giving a question at the end of this sentence here, but I'm going to put it there and hand it to you on a platter and say, what do you take from that?
I got you. I think first of all, competitor-wise, right now, we're pretty well situated in what we're doing, because really, we're not just going to stop at legal research. We're going to continue building an entire suite of AI assistants that help lawyers in a variety of different tasks, you know, putting together documents, contract review, a whole bunch of stuff that is on the horizon. But to kind of talk about what would happen if you have two different AI systems doing it, I think that would be fantastic, because what that would mean is that human lawyer is getting more of a variety of help, which is always a great thing, because what you're doing is when you go talk to your client, you've been exposed to a lot more information that can help them. In terms of the best way to see how Ross is performing is a couple ways. Well, one, you know, all the lawyers who use Ross actually upvote and downvote, so we can track that. But the other thing we love doing is, you know, getting the question that a lawyer has, and we tell them, hey, why don't you try using the old systems first, time yourself on how long it takes for you to get a good answer on it, and then ask Ross the same question. and see how long it takes for you to get to the, kind of that same point in your research. And we're seeing a pretty dramatic difference where, you know, to get together the different passages using the older systems, it could take you hours. But with ROS, if the passages you end up finding are in the top 10 or 20 results. And so, you know, it's saving lawyers a very large sum of time. And it's actually easy to track its performance doing that, kind of like just doing a comparison between the old methodology and our and using ROS. And of course, timing it. And I think that's very important because, you know, there's no doubt that you can get the same passages using Lexis and Westlaw. That's what we've been relying on for many years. It's just a matter of how long it takes and the easeability of that. And you know, I did legal research, and printing out a bunch of cases and reading those was something that I never really looked forward to.
Wow. Hearing Andrew talk through that, Joshua, I may have to recant my earlier statement about the lawyers who've gotten in touch with you talking about do not pay. They're using it to assist their clients and charging them for it. Maybe they're just being more efficient lawyers.
Well, they may well be more efficient in their personal, like in a personal sense, but the fact that they're still charging people when someone can log into the service and do it for free. But I think there's an important distinction here. I'm trying to help people with low-level consumer tasks, which previously they would have to look up for hours on these consumer rights websites or hire a lawyer $100 to do themselves. And so there's a really big distinction between kind of sophisticated law, which I think Andrew is working on, and these low-level tasks like flight delay compensation and parking tickets.
Yes, I definitely get the distinction that you're drawing there. We are here talking with Joshua Browder and Andrew Arruda about ROS Intelligence and Do Not Pay. We're going to be back in just a moment, but first we're going to thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is Braintree. If you're looking to set up payments for your business, Braintree gives your app or website a payment solution that accepts just about every payment with one single integration. It's code for easy mobile payments. Maybe you're working on the next Uber, Airbnb, or GitHub. Then why not use the same simple payment solution that helped them become what they are today? Braintree makes mobile payments so fast, easy, and seamless, it's almost magical. Add it to your app with just a few lines of code, and you're instantly ready to accept Apple Pay, Android Pay, PayPal, Venmo, credit cards, even Bitcoin. And if some other way to pay comes along, Braintree will support it too. Braintree's fast payouts and continuous support mean you'll always be ready, whether you're earning your first dollar or your billionth. See fewer abandoned carts and more sales with Braintree's best-in-class mobile checkout experience. Braintree gives you a full-stack payment solution support for all payment types your customers might want, single integration across all platforms with superior fraud protection, customer service, and fast payouts. To check it out for yourself, visit BraintreePayments.com/Twill. Thank you so much, Braintree, for your support of This Week in Law. Joshua, question for you about Do Not Pay and what it looks like on the user side. Is it an app? Is it a website? How do people interact with the chatbot?
It's a chatbot, and it can be accessed at the moment by going to donotpay.co.uk. I'm trying to integrate it with other platforms, for example, Facebook and Twitter. And I'm not looking to kind of favor one platform over the other. So at the moment, it's on the website, but very soon, hopefully, it will be right within your Messenger app.
Great. And similar question to you, Andrew. How are lawyers using ROS actually interacting with the AI? What does it look like to them? What devices can they do it from?
Yeah, so it's anywhere that you can access the internet. So it's a web-based program. ROS, you can use it on your mobile. You can use it on your iPad. You can use it on your desktop. So you just you're off and running in pretty much minutes.
Wow.
Great.
So from the field, that's very cool.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, sometimes what we're hearing is, you know, you could be in a meeting or whatnot, you know, you get a question, you just ask your question to ROS. We originally started with having it voice enabled. So you could just actually literally talk to it. But then we quickly, you know, law firms are quieter environments. So most of the users actually type it in.
I can't think of much things worse than listening to like a Hello Microsoft Sam voice reading off of some case briefs.
Yes, and I think we'll make AI to go our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law in honor of both systems that we're discussing here today. Getting back to a question that Emery had earlier, Andrew, about the role of Boolean search in operating AI. Although the lawyers who interact with Ross are using natural language, somewhere inside the black box, is there Boolean logic going on to extract the results?
No. So actually, you know, sometimes early on, as you continue to build out a product, we had tons of meetings with various lawyers. And some of them asked, you know, hey, why don't you just add on Boolean functionality just in case, you know, I that way I can still do that. And we didn't do that on purpose because the entire infrastructure is there's no Boolean or keyword in it. Really what Ross is doing is when you ask a question to it, it breaks down the sentence. It looks at the words in that question and it sees the relationship between those words and the other words in that question. And so it can decipher intent. And so that's why it's very powerful. It actually understands what you're asking. And then when you have a system that understands what you're asking, it can bring back better results. And because it understands you, it can also learn. And so then we layered on the machine learning so that it's always getting smarter.
Right. Machine learning, I think, is involved in both products we're talking about here. So I'd like both of you to kind of explain a little bit more how that develops over time. It sounds almost like in Ross's case, from something you said earlier, Andrew, that once results have been presented, the lawyers getting those results have the opportunity to rate how good they are. How fine-grained is that rating? How does that work?
Yeah, so it's very easy. It's an upvote or a downvote. And then there's a whole bunch of other factors that go into it. Like, you know, if someone has been practicing for 30 years, maybe their weight would be given a little bit more kind of more weight to that feedback. And that's kind of the more on the unsupervised side, whereas, you know, what you have is Ross in the field taking this feedback and getting smarter. But we also have a team internally that is also doing something with machine learning called supervised training, which is a more hands-on way of teaching an AI system. So we use machine learning and we both have supervised and unsupervised processes to have Ross continue to get smarter.
So I'm sorry, I'm just a little confused here about what this process looks like. When, let's say I have a client that comes in with a very specific bankruptcy case or bankruptcy issue, I happen to know generally the area of the law. Would I turn to Ross and write out my client's case, or would I ask them what is the relevant law, or how does that?
So you would just ask the question as it showed up. So say, for example, it's like, well, you know, I'm not sure if this qualifies as set off or recoupment, for example. You'd be like, well, you know, that's a good question. So you would just boot up Ross and say, what is the difference between set off and recoupment? And what Ross will do is it'll go through all of the case law and the legislation in that area and bring you back the different passages of law that best answer that question. So you can get really granular. You can even ask, Ross is what we call jurisdictionally aware. And what that means is you don't even have to click boxes anymore as to where you are and what law you want back. You can just say it in your question. So you can ask a question and then say, you know, can student loan debt be discharged in bankruptcy in Arizona or in the Ninth Circuit? And automatically Ross will filter its results for you and show you at the top all the different areas that it added on based on the fact you said what jurisdiction you wanted to search within. It's very intuitive.
That is so cool. When are you guys going to be in law schools, you know, taking the place of Westlaw and Lexis boot camps?
Well, hopefully very shortly. We have a few things in motion actually with some law schools. So we're excited about that. And we're also excited about offering Ross for free to legal aid clinics as well as, you know, different organizations that can benefit from it. As we continue to add on more areas, we look forward to having a system that is affordable, whether you're a solo to a large law firm, like I already said, but also offering it for free for, you know, deserving organizations.
That is absolutely incredible. That's awesome.
Again, I remember when Lexis and Westlaw were just starting to gain traction in law firms, and part of the way they gained it was to have it was completely free, and I'm sure it still is for law students. So, you know, they got used to doing research in one way that didn't involve paper books, and the legal profession pretty much had to pay attention because that's how people had been educated to do research. I guess that's a good question for you, Andrew, is paper books still exist in law firms and people still occasionally pull them down off the shelf, oftentimes just to read a case. I don't know, the days of trying to go through head notes and track through research that way are probably not still with us except in very, very small supply. Do you think that Ross and paper books and the online services that exist today will all coexist?
I think for the short term, I think the goal for us is similar to what you saw with Netflix. Eventually, we want to be able to do everything start to finish so that we're the only service available that you would want to use. Mm-hmm.
Joshua, we talked about pushback from lawyers who your service is disintermediating. I wonder, it can't be terribly popular with the city governments of London and New York and wherever else you're going to roll out because you're concretely diminishing their revenue. Have you had any conversations along those lines?
No direct conversations, but it's worth mentioning that they absolutely hate me. And the reason I know that is because on the back end, I can see who signs up for the website. And every jurisdiction in the UK, we have 200, they're called councils, 200 sub-jurisdictions. And every single one has signed up. They try and poke holes in the robot, try and find what exactly it's generating. And I think what they're trying to do is find out exactly what the site produces so that they can like be harsher on those in their appeals. But I've found my own ways around that. But on the national level, loads of government officials have actually been very supportive, but the local governments really don't like me.
Yes, I don't foresee that changing for you anytime soon. Hey, I understand, Joshua, that you need to go. We're going to continue doing the show for another 15 minutes or so with Andrew. But I just want to thank you so much, Joshua, for joining us today. Pick your brain as to anything else that you wanted to get out today that you haven't been able to mention to our viewers and listeners about Do Not Pay, about anything else you're working on, just things for people to keep their eyes on before we let you go.
No, but just I'm really looking forward to expand to other areas of the law. Over the summer, I'm working on the refugee crisis in Europe to try and help Syrian refugees claim asylum in the UK. So that's very exciting. But thank you so much for having me on. It's been really a pleasure to speak to you and Andrew. And yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much. Really, really great stuff. And congratulations on the great work you've done and will continue to do.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. Let's see. What shall we turn to along the lines of Ross? Let's talk about Centaur Lawyers. This is something that you've talked about in many interviews, and it comes from the concept of Centaur Chess. I found an excerpt based on one of your quotes, Andrew, from a book called The Rise of the Centaurs that talks about this concept and really captures this notion of melding a human with a machine intelligence. And it's talking in the chess context here, but here's a quote from that book. It's talking about beating Deep Blue, I believe. Why could these relative amateurs beat chess players with far more experience and raw talent? Oh, no, they're talking about beating human players here. Because Crampton and Steven were expert at collaborating with computers. They knew when to rely on human smarts and when to rely on the machine's advice. Working at rapid speed, these games too were limited to 60 minutes. They would brainstorm moves, then check to see what the computer thought, while also scouring databases to see if the strategy had occurred in previous games. They used three different computers simultaneously, running five different pieces of software. That way they could cross-check whether different programs agreed on the same move. but they wouldn't simply accept what the machine accepted, nor would they merely mimic old games. They selected moves that were low rated by the computer if they thought they would rattle their opponents psychologically. So that seems like a really good analogy for what you might be able to accomplish with Ross.
Like, how cool is that passage? I really love it. Our CTO actually recently, I think, tweeted that out as well. And so that's something that you're going to see in law. And if you notice in that passage, it does such a great job, because what it's showing is you have multiple systems that can help you. You're using multiple systems and you're making the best decision. But the very, you know, at the end, when they said to rattle the psyche of their opponents, really what that means is that there is still that human kind of component that is just wonderful. And so to have all those systems working together with those humans, they ended up beating experts. And so imagine what you can do as you kind of build out that toolkit in your practice. You're going to be able to do a lot more for your client. And I think that's really exciting.
I know we just lost Joshua, and I know obviously that, Andrew, you are really focused on the Centaur lawyer. But when you were saying earlier that you were thinking about expanding Ross outside of just legal research, I'm thinking that at some point along the line, you are going to get to the situation where it's much closer to Joshua's sort of turnkey solution for consumers, where for a lot of legal issues that, you know, might be as small as parking tickets today, but might rise to, you know, licensing contracting issues tomorrow, somewhere along the way, it's going to be full automation. Or do you think that it's the Centaur way all the way down?
I think by seeing what happened in chess, provides us with a really great layout of what's going to happen, because you had an extremely difficult, complex thing, being chess, a system, and then a machine beating it. But then what you're seeing in chess is that when you combine the forces of both, it doesn't lose to either a single machine system or a single human. And so I think it's always going to be in the interest to have the human at the dead center of the system that we're building. And as we continue to build out different functionalities and capabilities, it's all really based at having the human lawyer at the center. Because together, as you saw with chess, Centaur lawyers are going to be something that are extremely powerful and will be able to do a lot more good, especially when you consider that 80% of folks can't actually afford a lawyer right now. So I think the future is really bright when it comes to when you actually have that that melding of machine and human lawyer.
So what areas outside of bankruptcy, sorry, Denise, but what areas outside of bankruptcy law do you think that Ross is currently especially suited for, or that you guys are, if you can talk about it, I guess, on the horizon?
What's really cool, actually, is that because what happens with machine learning is it's actually agnostic to the particular practice area it's learning. So what Ross is learning with right now is not how to be a good bankruptcy law researcher, just how to be a good researcher. And so we can go into any area that we'd like. And what's really neat is that we could actually help transfer some of the learnings that Ross took in bankruptcy and layer that on top of another practice area that it goes into. So we'd start further ahead than we did with bankruptcy, because there'd be knowledge we can essentially pass over. And then what's really neat is, as you have various practice areas going, all that learning is helping each other. So it's really going to be a kind of an exponential situation where Ross continues to learn even quicker. But as to what areas are next, what we do is we talk to the firms that we are working with and ask them essentially where will having Ross offer the biggest impact. And we use direct feedback from lawyers and law firms as our roadmap.
Yeah, speaking of the feedback, I wanted to get back to the machine learning and how Ross gets smarter issue. You mentioned it's right now just a thumbs up, thumbs down kind of feedback process on each particular result, and weighted by who the responder is, whether they are very experienced or mildly so. Are you thinking of making that more fine-grained? Because I could certainly see scenarios where Ross gets one part of an analysis right, but whiffs on a different part and could benefit from getting that feedback.
Yeah, so actually those are just the factors that were listed off are just a few of the factors that go into it. I'm not allowed to list them all, or else our CTO would probably come and and take me away. But there's a lot of different kind of things that we put into it, and I've tried different methods to see which ones work best. So there's that thumbs up, thumbs down. But there's a variety of different ways Ross is learning as well, and a lot of that would be proprietary. But all this to say, what's really neat is that you have a system that's dynamic. It's not static. And so the law is always changing, our profession's changing, and our system is actually evolving and moving along with the human lawyer and keeping up with that change of pace and that change of understanding. And I think that's what's really exciting about machine learning and what we're doing. But I think, you know, as we continue forward, like I said, we're going to be building out AIs for a variety of different things for lawyers. And I think I just get really excited about this stuff, and I can't wait to see, you know, what's going to be around in the next year and 2 years, because Ross is only 1 year old, actually. So we've only been around for about a year.
Right. I mean, it seems document review seems like very low hanging fruit for you. that kind of a process could definitely benefit from AI more than the kinds of systems that we see in place now, which are, you know, basically just good, hopefully they're good search tools. Sometimes, the thing that I remember most from working at a large law firm and doing document review is how often the automated systems we used didn't get you what you needed to get. I suppose you always remember the negatives, don't you? It seemed like there were enough mess ups that those are what stood out in my mind, and you still needed to throw armies of lawyers at those boxes of documents or those, you know, very large hard drives full of imaged documents or full text documents to find what it is you were looking for. Can you give us any insight as to how AI would tackle that kind of needle in a haystack problem that document review involves?
Well, that's actually where it excels. Where AI is excelling is finding needles in haystack, making sense of data that is complex and very vast. And so actually on the doc review side, it's not something we do, but there is competitions now where they put human lawyers up against different doc review systems, and the doc review systems have been winning consistently on that. And actually, but you know, what's really neat is the fact that you said early on, it would still mess up and it wasn't finding everything. But what's really neat with machine learning is that you would be able to then tell that system it missed something, and so that it would actually continue to learn from those mess ups rather than just not learning. Mm. And so I think that's the big breakthrough with these systems, is that early days when we started piloting Ross, you know, of course, you know, some legal terminology would trip it up. But then with great feedback, both on, you know, the supervised side, which is more of a manual teaching method, and also as it learns unsupervised, it continues to get smarter. So, you know, your example is perfect, because you would actually be able to help with that mess up that system next time. Maybe it wouldn't mess up at all. And then as you continue to use it, it would have gotten smarter and smarter.
So I have a follow-up about that, actually. First off, I love that the proper term for using an AI is piloting. I just learned that. That's very clever and like it a lot. my question, though, is thinking about the chess example and the recent AI that beat the world expert on, or the world's best Go player. I know that one of the frequent criticisms of the idea of like AI lawyers is that lawyers are frequently having to make creative decisions or creative connections between laws or cases that seem disconnected. And obviously that is Ross's main strength. But have you guys in piloting Ross and sort of testing it and using it in the field, have you seen it come up with especially surprising solutions or connections that maybe at first glance appeared completely wrong, but then a more subtle analysis said that these were connected?
Yeah, I think we get that a lot, actually. Sometimes what will happen is a lawyer will ask a question and you know the case that they're looking for. So they ask the question, they're like, I noticed it brought this case up, but it only brought it down here. It's like, well, did you consider looking at the other ones that it brought back? And then they're like, oh, wait, this is actually even more helpful. And so it's neat because it's that different perspective that we're giving humans through when Ross brings up those passages. And we do see kind of like, oh, no, but I know what the case that I want for this is. But then they end up seeing other cases that perhaps they hadn't used before, but that, you know, they could have and should have.
Hmm. Andrew, question for you about, again, getting to Ross's sources and how it handles different inputs that it gets. We have in the United States a couple of different ways that law gets handed to us and then has to be applied in specific cases. We get statutory law, the laws that are actually enacted by state and the federal government, and you can get out into the weeds as to applying the statutory law, what the statutes actually mean. Mm-hmm. And then you get case law, which develops over time and is complicated, and I think is by and large what you have been discussing today, yes. What you've been having in the back of your mind as we've been talking about Ross. So can you speak for just a moment to the difference, how Ross handles those two kinds of sources differently?
Yeah. Well, Ross learned first on legislation, and then we taught Ross case law. So mm-hmm. we use the legislation as kind of a skeleton and kind of building block and built on top of that. But how it deals with it is the same way. I mean, when the question is asked, it looks through its essentially, it goes into its brain, which is all the documents, all the case law from the inception of the courts to date, and then prepares and comes up with the passages it feels best answers that question. So it handles both, which is mm-hmm. pretty exciting. And I think, you know, the other really neat thing we've done is the law is always changing. And we know this, and, you know, we can help lawyers up front with being more efficient, but we wanted to actually do something that no one had done before. And what we have is something called our law monitor. And so after you ask a question to Ross, you can just click a button and have Ross now monitor not a case, but actually the entire legal question you asked. And, you know, as Ross continues to learn, it could push notify you and say, hey, you know, I've been doing some more research and this new passage came up and you should check this out. Yeah. And if a new case comes out, for example, and that's relevant enough, it'll alert you to that as well. So it's not just helping you up front, but also helping you around the clock. And I think that's really neat.
That is very neat.
Yes, it is. We're going to make Centaur Pilots our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. If you're wondering what that is, if you are a lawyer or other professional who likes to listen to or watch the show and receive professional credit in your field, that's something we certainly encourage you to do. And for lawyers, we have some more information for you, at least in the U.S., at wiki.twit.tv/thisweekinlaw. You will find there a map of our 50 jurisdictions and how you can go about applying for credit in any of them. Thank you to Franklin Graves, who is listening to the show today, for generating that chart for us. Hi, Franklin. I see you there in IRC. We're going to go ahead and bring this very interesting show in for a landing, lighten things up a little bit with our animal selfie of the week for you. So I don't know how I missed this back in March, but I'm thrilled to be able to highlight it for you here in July. And that is that Google partnered up with the LA Zoo in some sort of promotion for Disney's Zootopia movie and put a bunch of automatic cameras that could be, I don't know how automatic they are. I think they're actually triggered by the animals.
Yes.
yes. Zoogle selfies. It was a way of not only promoting Zootopia, but also Google's photo sharing and management service. And here we have tigers and elephants and various critters at the Los Angeles Zoo taking selfies of themselves. So again, the reason we highlight these animal selfies each week is because they definitely seem to be a cultural phenomenon in many different ways. And because from the legal standpoint, it's fun to think about who has the intellectual property rights to them. Here we have animals actually activating the triggers and capturing some very nice photos and videos. So yet another example of that happening in the wild. We have a couple of resources for you this week. Number one, topically enough for our show today, is an event that's coming up next week on July 19th, sponsored by the Wikimedia Foundation. It's going to be in San Francisco, I believe, on AI and the law. I assume you're going to be attending that, Andrew.
Well, our CTO is going to be at that event, Gimo Viagle. He'll be at that. And actually, during the same day, I'll be at the American Association of Legal Librarians conference they're having in Chicago. So whether you're in Chicago, you can come see me there. And or if you're in San Francisco, this Wikimedia event is going to be fantastic.
Right. Intersection of the law and emerging technologies such as driverless cars, web crawlers, and lethal autonomous weapons, which we just recently did a show about. And I believe Rebecca Krutoff, who we had on that show, is one of the people who is either in charge of putting on this event or will be at this event. So it's going to be Tuesday, July 19th at 6 p.m. at the Wikimedia Foundation in San Francisco. If you're in the Bay Area, definitely something fun to check out. Also, another resource for you that Andrew highlighted in his Twitter feed when he wasn't busy letting us know that a wild oryx had appeared when he was delayed during air travel. Artificial Lawyer blog, a blog about AI and legal automation news and views, something to check out at artificiallawyer.com. Our tip of the week, again, topically tied to our show, is that the law still needs lawyers. And one thing that you might want to do is put out some shirts along these lines, Andrew. I found somewhere in my social media travels a shirt that allows people to proclaim, please don't confuse your Google search with my law degree. Maybe Ross needs something similar. And also a great concrete example, a little video we're going to play for you from a law firm in Texas that helps people out with their various misdemeanor. They hope that all you're going to be charged with is a misdemeanor kind of activity related to your stash. This is from Hudson and Harris, attorneys. Don't eat your weed.
Don't eat your weed. Moving down the road, you're driving pretty slow because you've got some marijuana on you. Really love pot, it's not a whole lot, just an ounce or maybe two. Oh, oh, red and blues flashing in the rear view. You pull off to the shoulder, no, please don't eat your weed, is it suddenly a class B?
I just love these guys. And of course, you need the lawyer to advise you that should you follow that panicky instinct and actually eat your weed, you're looking at more of a felony charge there because you are obstructing justice and messing with evidence and all those bad things. So there you go. I don't know how could Ross tell you not to eat your weed?
Well, I don't know if Ross could have such a wonderful singing voice. They actually are very good. I think they might have gone into the wrong profession.
I think so. I just love everything about that. So why the law still needs lawyers is so they can sing you to hopefully just a misdemeanor and not a felony. It's been a fabulous show. We are so excited that you could join us, Andrew. So excited about what you're doing in the law. I'll ask you what I asked Joshua, if there's anything else on the horizon that you want our listeners and viewers to know about before we go ahead and sign off with you today.
Nothing on the horizon, but if you'd like to keep up to date with what we're up to, just there at our website, you can zip us an email if you're interested in bringing Ross to your firm, or follow me on Twitter there at Andrew Arruda.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Andrew, for joining us. Emery, always fun to chat with you. Be safe out there. It was merely a week ago that you were making me realize I am each and every one of my 51 years old when I didn't realize that the Pokemon Go game that was released last Friday involved getting up out of the house and going outside. Yes. Yeah. Now I know that in spades. I know it more than I wish I did know it. And just as a programming note, we are going to have a Pokemon Go oriented show next week. Remind me who our guests are again, Emery, who are going to show up for that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, we have... I'm sorry. Actually, I need to pull that up. I don't want to misspeak anyone's name.
Yeah, I know. I have to. We've some great people, and their names are not on the tip of my tongue. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to sandbag you with that. Tiffany Lee is one of them. I remember that.
Yeah.
And Derek? What is Derek's last name? He's coming.
This is awful. I'm sorry.
No. I put you on the spot. Derek, I found on Twitter.
Derek Mueller.
Yes, Derek Mueller. He's a professor at Pepperdine and someone who had been playing Ingress for a long time and considering all the legal issues related to it. And so he and Tiffany are going to come on and help us grok this new phenomenon more thoroughly on the privacy front and liability front on any number of levels. So that will be next week. The 22nd, if you'd like to tune in for that, if you can tell the Raichu outside your house to wait a little longer that you'll catch it after the show, you can join us next week for that. And you can join us each and every week at 11 o'clock on Fridays. That's when we record the show live, 11 PT, 1800 UTC. If you go to twit.tv, that's what we'll be on then. But don't worry, if you can't join us in that particular window of time, you can go to our site at twit.tv/twill. The entire archive of This Week in Law episodes is there. There's also tons of information there about how you can enjoy the show on whatever device you would like, wherever you would like to enjoy it. So we encourage you to settle back, dig into the archives, enjoy This Week in Law, however it makes sense for you. Certainly wandering around in the world, catching Pokemon, we would love to be your soundtrack for that. So this has just been a great, wonderful time, glimpse into the future. Thank you so much, Andrew. Thank you so much, Joshua Browder, who joined us as well. We will see you next time on This Week in Law. Take care.